Hi, my name is Yuriko Furuhata. I teach Japanese cinema and media here at McGill. I will be chairing this panel today, panel on surveillance. So let me just quickly introduce our first presenter, Professor Karen Kaplan. She teaches in American Studies department at the University of California at Davis. She is the author of Questions of Travel, Postmodern Discourses of Displacement. She has also co-authored and edited a number of books, including Introduction to Women's Studies, Between Women and Nation, and Scattered Hegemonies. She's also the author of two digital multimedia works entitled Dead Reckoning and Precision Targets. And she's completing a book on aerial views and militarized visual culture. And I believe her talk today maybe is coming out from that project. Title of her talk is The Emotion of Motion, Exceeding the Visual in Aerostatic Spacing. So please welcome Karen.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank Jonathan and Nick and Tamar and everyone involved in organizing this conference, not only for the concept, which intrigued and excited me the moment I heard about it, but also for the meticulous and thoughtful planning, which is very much appreciated by travelers and conference goers. In the interest of time, I'm going to be reading this, hopefully in as interactive a way as I can. On a beautiful day, in the early autumn of 1785, a balloon floated into the sky, lifting off from the town of Chester in northern England. The sole occupant, Thomas Baldwin, took detailed notes and made sketches of the countryside along the way. This flight represented the culmination of Baldwin's passionate desire to get into a balloon and up into the air and thereby be a part of the very latest scientific breakthrough of the age, the invention of a balloon with enough lift to carry a human being. Baldwin rented the balloon from Vincenzo Lunardi, the elegantly cosmopolitan entrepreneurial advocate of British Aerostation, who was in the vicinity of Chester selling tickets to his own launches, and in some cases, as his funds dipped perilously low, renting out his vehicle to enthusiasts such as Baldwin. Baldwin, however, was not just any local yokel with the end to fly. He had been studying the sciences involved in aerostation, avidly following the latest news from France, as the Montgolfier brothers and Professor Jacques Charles had amazed crowds in the hundreds of thousands with their experimental flights. And he was almost desperately frustrated by the lack of interest in aerostation on the part of the British scientific establishment, in marked contrast to the rapid and deep investment in the science on the part of the French government. An autodidact of modest means, Baldwin's plan for an innovative aerostat of his own design languished for lack of influential sponsors and obdurate attitudes in the Royal Society. The opportunity to rent Lunardi's balloon was a life-changing experience for Baldwin, the realization of his hopes to participate in one of the most exciting arenas in scientific research. Baldwin published his voluminous notes and observations on aerostation the following year under the title Aeropaedia, overshadowed by more famous works, criticized in the literary reviews of the time for a decided inelegance in style that betrayed the author's class origins. This volume has fallen into obscurity until relatively recently. It interests me tremendously because Aeropaedia's four illustrations are the first published aerial views based on sketches produced by a person in flight. Resonant with the emerging scientific emphasis on eyewitness observation, these balloon prospects signal new forms of representation as well as established pictorial conventions. They intrigue me due to their four very separate methods of representing the view from above, as well as what seems to me to be a fairly powerful aura. After looking at the images online for several years, it was a revelation for me to open carefully a copy of Baldwin's book in the British Library reading room, a volume of much smaller dimensions than I had imagined, almost tiny, and find Baldwin's images sparkling with bright colors, absolutely beautiful, moving me to tears. I had traveled 9,000 miles to see these illustrations in place, as it were, four pages in a very old book that's now too fragile to move very far itself. What did I think I was looking at, and why did it move me so? The project I've been working on for some years now concerns both the sense of sight as an embodied practice and some of the material things that result from that practice, images. In particular, I've been thinking about images that depict views from above. I start with the advent of aerostation, human flight, and hot air or hydrogen balloons in the late 18th century, and the first prints and engravings that reflected a new quest for empirical observation, and move on to the late 18th and early 19th century panoramic paintings and military ordnance surveys, as well as 20th century aerial reconnaissance photography, winding up in the midst of the revolution in military affairs, signaled by the sensing capacities of satellites and drones. The front section of this project takes as axiomatic in late 18th and 19th century Western culture the emerging dominance of the visual as a sensory practice that emphasized increasingly the requirement to observe in person, to be there physically, as a material presence. As Giuliana Bruno reminds us, in the 18th century, a great shift occurred as discourse in its many manifestations acceded to eyewitness observation, as she puts it, as the tongue gave way to the eye. But we all know that the narrative of vision's conquest of sensory experience in modernity is a little too pat. The publication in the early 1900s of Martin Jay's Downcast Eyes traced a deeply rooted anti-ocularism throughout Western culture, while Bruno Latour's important essay, Drawing Things Together from roughly the same time period, argued against a fetishized focus on images themselves in favor of an examination of the ways in which representations travel and ultimately influence people. I take seriously the critiques of representation issued from the STS and social science schools of thought. But what to do with images? They never cease to interest me, and I believe there's always more to learn about them. So to my mind, a critique of the dominance of vision in the emergence and expansion of Western European modernity should not require discarding all analyses of vision and its cultural products and practices. In particular, the ways in which vision operates in warfare in the past and present calls for scholarship that explores what counts as vision in the history of sensing. What's at stake in distinguishing views or visual representation over or against other forms of sensing? And what can account for the persistence of vision as a symbol, metaphor, or marker of emphasis in discussions of military or wartime operations? In this effort, I've been inspired by the work of cultural geographer Derek McCormick. Specifically, his theorization of remote sensing helps me to think beyond the visual, opening the way out of the stricter confines of visual culture studies to something I suppose we could call vision plus. McCormick draws on a geospatial technology, remote sensing, to explore the possibilities of affective perception, utilizing this satellite platform as a metaphor for distanced observation, but also as a set of material practices that create time and space and modernity. Remote sensing is usually associated with a privileging of vision and an affirmation of the cartographic abstraction that contributes to the expansion and violent enactment of imperial power. In this view, remote sensing, through its operation of distance, can only objectify and work against the richly subjective situated knowledge and politics of location that are often proposed as modes of resistance to state power and empire. And I would just add, this was a line of argument I took myself in earlier work, and it's just rife. It's everywhere. It's pretty much the line. But McCormick argues, and I've been really dissatisfied with it, but McCormick argues we can understand remote sensing as much more than instrumental alienation. In fact, it behooves us to understand the full range and scales of distance, including intimacy and connection. The conventional binary between distance and proximity and its related oppositions, objective and subjective, global and local, unfamiliar and familiar, stranger and intimate, may be culturally and historically specific to Western modernity, but even within that narrow register of human experience, there's ample evidence of greater nuance and possibility than these bluntly foreclosed extremes. Accordingly, McCormick asks us to consider remote sensing, as he puts it, not so much as a technology of distanced, elevated image capture, but as a set of mobile and modest techniques through which affective materials are sensed without direct contact or touch. This mode of worldly apprehension acknowledges that the relationship between the material and the immaterial is never fully resolved and is therefore productive of ways of knowing and being that do not always square literally and figuratively with the Cartesian bounded subject and may not always operate congruently with the aims of empire and its military and security apparatus. Remote sensing, at its most basic level, is the art or science of telling something about an object without touching it. Familiar with photography, as most of us are these days, we can easily grasp this primary concept that undergirds so much visual culture studies. Representation conveys information, even narrativizes an object that's apprehended at a distance. Indeed, the process of representation renders everything into an object, a scene, a view, a portrait, etc. The practice of photography requires machinery to capture an image in contrast to the manual techniques of drawing or painting, but all forms of representation narrow elements of the world into a series of selected units that become transformed into a perceivable material object. The key aspect in this process is the distance between the viewer and viewed. The representation is a view perceived and delivered without touch by sight. This seems straightforward enough, but McCormick reminds us that materiality, the image, is full of affect, and affect is difficult to apprehend and represent. His work as a geographer leads him to consider that the experience of space and place is always haunted by a non-coincident spatio-temporality. These are his words. Haunted by a non-coincident spatio-temporality in which past and future participate simultaneously and in unpredictable ways. He makes recourse to the concept of the spectral to convey this uneven and even discordant experience of the immense intensity of the relationship between living and dead, between past and the expectation of a future. Of course, this uncanny disturbance in the environment of daily life is what Freud termed the Unheimlich, referring to the unfamiliar and the familiar, the unhome and the home, as it were, a kind of haunting by the dead or the past in the world of the living in present time and place. This is less about figurative ghosts and more about a kind of crack or slip between time and space, the non-coincident spatio-temporality that reminds us that our operative reality may be far more limited than some of us might like to acknowledge. In McCormick's work, then, the spectral, as he puts it, is a constitutive element of geographical experience, taking place as a persistent and unsettling capacity of place to enchant and haunt. I found this reconceptualization of materiality as the opening up to the enchanted and haunted layers and possibilities of simultaneous and unpredictably apprehended pasts, presents, and futures to be enormously helpful in thinking about landscapes and views of terrain, the ways in which they have or have not been sensed or surveyed. Places mean a great deal to people. There are obvious associations on a personal or cultural level that can lead to the desire to commemorate, record, or mark the relationship between person and place in any number of ways. Even the most banal or nondescript place may be full of a history that might matter to someone, or did matter. Now unrecognized or unimportant, seemingly impossible to know. Above all, the unresolved ambivalence of haunting links us to another Freudian trope, melancholia, and the veritable illness that the loss of an object may engender when that loss exceeds the work of mourning to become psychically prolonged. While mourning eventually lessens, melancholia cannot end, in part due to the generalized and pervasive nature of the affective experience. The melancholic believes that a loss has occurred, but cannot see clearly what it is that has been lost. I don't think it's an accident that we use the word see clearly here. The spectral haunting of place, then, signals a loss that cannot be fully perceived. Time and space are disturbed in this condition, both expanded and limited. And the melancholic anomie and numbness towards others, inspired by a loss that cannot be fully perceived or comprehended consciously, produces worlds of experience and knowledge that are out of sync, non-coincident, almost palpable. So far, I've been playing kind of fast and loose with terms, slipping between emotion, feeling, affect, etc., to refer to a range of embodied sensory intensities, but McCormick's usage is intentionally and rigorously specific. Affect, the term he puts to work for the most intense theoretical operations, he defines as an ongoing potential of prepersonal relations immanent to the world, always in excess of actuality. In other words, affect is like an atmosphere. It might not be visible, but at any given point it might be sensed. Feeling can be understood as affect sensed in moving bodies, human or non-human, while emotion is the socio-cultural expression of this felt intensity. McCormick works his way toward a fourth syncretic approach that develops repertoires of enactive practices through which the relational, processual, and affective materialities of space and place might be apprehended. It should be clear at this point that these diverse operations of spectrality cannot be reduced simply to cartographic imperialism or dismissed as totalizing projects of techno-scientific mastery. Remote sensing in these spectral aspects is more than visual, taking place through multiple registers that include vision, but also touch, sound, and the processual and relational experiences of movement and stillness. In my reading of McCormick's work thus far, I've considered that something more than the visual can be registered in the theorized practice of remote sensing, and that this affective perception of non-synchronous time and space both builds and disturbs our world. In my work, I've been stitching this idea to Mary Favret's reanimation of this question in her wonderful book, War at a Distance. Favret, a literary critic, reads 19th century British romantic poetry against the grain to argue that the time and space of war throughout the early to mid-19th century was momentously constitutive of everyday life in Britain, disturbing profoundly the supposed division between home and away, city and country, imperial center and colony, battlefield and domestic hearth. In this period, when Britain was becoming westernized, as Sari Makdisi reminds us, over and against its internal and external colonial others, war was waged in many places, but no longer on British soil. The violence of war occurred on battlefields far away and therefore could be forgotten, suppressed, ignored, or compartmentalized. Yet, Favret argues, despite material and emotional experiences of distance, warfare haunted British culture. War became a processual, spectral presence through its remoteness, a wartime understood to be a persistent mode of daily life and a habit of mind. It's even due to its distance from the home front that war structures quotidian life, less spectacular, violent exception, and more a steady, constant possibility of violence, both received and directed against others. As Favret writes, war in this era was shown to operate both globally and simultaneously within the everyday. I'm sorry. One second. There we go. I'll blame it on jet lag. War in this era was shown to operate both globally and simultaneously within the everyday. Taken as a ubiquitous system, war was at once unremarkable and nearly imperceptible, something non-evident that could not always be made evident. Felt and unfelt, impersonal and intimate, war became, for those experiencing it at a distance, a not fully conscious awareness that could flare up or flicker out. Here Favret defines what she calls wartime, a concept I'm linking to McCormick's non-coincident spatiotemporality. The affective zone of wartime produced an unsubtle present that dislocated bounded terrain as well as outcomes of knowledge to extend war into a realm without clear limits. This kind of distant, endless warfare with no limits or endpoint created an atmosphere that Favret describes as strange and familiar, intimate and remote, present and yet not really here. The colonial wars in Favret's study were ambiguous, difficult to mark clearly with beginnings and endings or in terms of limited boundaries. Most importantly, this new kind of time and space introduced vulnerability into a British population that expected daily life to be lived in the absence of the threat of war, insinuating a set of disturbing affective responses and that she lists as numbness, dizziness, anxiety, or a sense of being overwhelmed. The poets that are the subjects of Favret's study explore this affective territory, probing the terrors and pleasures of the axis between security and insecurity, for, as Favret argues, domestic quiet is meaningless without this threat of interruption and resulting vulnerability. When I first read Favret's book, I was struck by the powerful similarities between the affective culture of Britain in the early to mid-19th century and this period in which we live now that's colloquially referred to as the War on Terror. Perhaps it's more accurate to say that the earlier period inaugurated practices that remain available to us today as the United States and its allies fight wars far from home ground against non-state actors who may operate across and state, who may operate across geographic scales from extremely local to expansively transnational. In many ways, in Favret's description of another place and time, I recognize the affective environment in the United States today. In particular, through her delineation of three possible responses to this kind of modern warfare. First, and most significantly, for my own study of aerial imagery, Favret argues that wartime produces an abstract viewpoint legible only from a distance, as from a bird's eye view. This distance view renders war as an object of knowledge, discernible through patterns, cartographic, if you will, reminding me strongly of the practice anthropologist James Scott has termed seeing like a state, the narrowing and simplification that produces legible data. Secondly, Favret points out that this is not my system, so I'm having trouble. Here we go, seeing like state, okay. And it's sideways. Secondly, Favret points out that wartime reduces human responsiveness across registers such that lack of feeling or inertia and apathy becomes overwhelmingly dominant, generating ever greater anomie and despair. Favret identifies one more response to wartime, suspended between abstraction and numbness, a poetic or aesthetic response that strives to produce or give form to feeling and thereby open wartime to the present. Without celebrating or romanticizing the benefits of war, this acknowledgement of the haunting of the present by other spaces and times offers possibilities of affective perception, a possible opening, a move from melancholia's enemy to a more vibrant embrace of living. As Avery Gordon has put it, being haunted draws us affectively, sometimes against our will, always a bit magically, into the structure of feeling of a reality we come to experience, not as cold knowledge, but as transformative recognition. I said earlier that images in Baldwin's Aeropaedia moved me, and I'd like to take the last few minutes of my talk to explore the balloon prospects as a transformative recognition of the structure of feeling as vision plus, or something beyond vision, a remote sensing. I began this book project intent on addressing the visual culture of air power. I was certain that air war was one of the great evils of modernity, and I wanted to better understand the role of cartography and aviation in that enterprise. I still hold these views, but one of the most astonishing things that happened to me in writing this book was my encounter with the late 18th and early 19th century. It's a time period in which so many of the things I care about now came into being, especially pertaining to mapping, warfare, and aerial imagery. I had thought I would just dip into it, write a little section of a first chapter on aerostation, and then zoom through a short discussion of panoramic paintings, and then get back to my main engagement with 20th and 21st century air power. That was about 5 years ago. Learning about balloons changed what I know about so many things. It transformed the project as a whole. I didn't want to write about affect. Affect was a trendy buzzword in the period just preceding this moment in my project, and I was turned off by a lot of that work. I absolutely did not want to get pulled back into anything approaching psychoanalytic theory or subjectivity. I was occupied increasingly with the history of aerial surveying in the Middle East and the continuities and discontinuities with air power over more than 100 years in that region. But the more I read the histories and accounts of the first balloonists, I found that the strict distinction assumed in our time between art and science was not very much in evidence, disturbing the pat narrative of Enlightenment cartographic mastery. The physicists, chemists, and adventurers who launched themselves into the skies in flimsy vehicles all expressed wonder and awe, even as they conducted experiments and collected specimens of air. They were determined, confused, excited, defeated, elated, awed, often simultaneously. I don't want to get too carried away with a romantic sublime, however. They also thought avidly about how to use this technology for warfare. But at first, I really didn't know what to make of any of this. And at this point, I can identify three primary enacted practices and attitudes engendered through aerostation: the directed intention to conduct rigorous observational science, the overwhelming sublimity of the view, and military mindedness. And they have to be considered in relation to each other and never without each other in this case, this situation. The more I learned about early aerostation, the more I was struck by the simultaneity of these responses and practices. Ballooning opened to the present the affects of exhilaration, fear, and wonder, as well as the potential to see abstractly and to marshal scales of distance for cartographic observation. These first aerialists were experiencing something on the level of the body no one else, or at least no modern Europeans, had ever known. They flew. In flight, from flight, they described sensory changes of all kinds. Sound was altered. Familiar objects looked strange or appeared to be the wrong color or were flattened in appearance. Temperature extremes stressed and tested their bodies. Their sense of movement was entirely strange. This moment of multitudinous and disassembled sensing draws me in. Perhaps it's just the alluring intimation of the possibility of looking without mastery. Giuliana Bruno's written about the modern experience of motion as productive emotion, based on the Latin root of the word emotion, which speaks to a moving force, a transference from one place to another. Emotion, she writes, is haptic. It expresses desire as an embodied spatial practice. McCormick terms this felt sense of vertiginous events as aerostatic spacing, the being and becoming lighter than air. This kind of movement does not establish modern vision's exceptionalism to any full extent, or perhaps another way to put it is this. As the mind's eye endeavors to pull together a cartographic abstraction, the rest of the body becomes aerostatic in flight via three key experiences identified by McCormick as envelopment, inflation, and buoyancy, which I don't have time to talk about more today. These affective assemblages work against coherency and universalism. They each incorporate material things or experiential qualities. The balloon, temperature, sunlight, pressure, volumes of gas, gusts of wind, etc., in expansive relationships of varying velocities, differential energies and temperatures, dynamic and kinetic encounters. I want to be careful here. The Italian futurists got a big rush from flight, and we know that they drew on that adrenaline and sense of freedom to pursue fascist forms of biopolitics to deadly effect. The pursuit of sensation as a paratroop seems to be the opposite of McCormick's notion of aerostatic spacing. And I'm lifting this out of context from McCormick's discussion of Spinoza, Derrida, Masumi, Bennett, etc., and that can easily cause us to stray into dangerous territory. I can also be charged with literally making light of the history and all-too-present horror of aerial bombing, a topic I've immersed myself in for over 15 years and that I'm dedicated to analyze. I feel that I offer this analysis at some risk of unpopularity on a panel on surveillance, but it's precisely due to this immersion that I welcome the opportunity to write this paper, because it seemed to present me with a chance to work out for myself and to share with you how this project has shifted from one conducted purely within the terms of visual culture studies of representation to one that situates images in a more ontological register, Vision Plus. The last few years I've been writing and giving talks on and off about drones, trying to catch my book project up with the rapidly developing technoscape, circling around and through the balloon prospects, the early panoramic paintings, the military ordnance surveys, and the first iterations of analog reconnaissance photography, and dipping into the vast arena of electronic and digital sensing mobilized for wartime. It's dizzying in and of itself. I'm a historian by necessity, not by training. So my emotional attachments remain always deeply entangled in the present. This is the context in which I share Baldwin's balloon prospects, not as an exemplary caution over and against the naive or premilitarized affective registers of aerial experience, but as a deadly serious problem. How we got from here to there is not a straight line and therefore cannot be simply reversed. There is a growing literature that makes complicated our understanding of how unmanned aerial vehicles work, how their sensing capacities operate, and especially how many of the drone operators are subject to post-traumatic stress disorder due to the intense intimacy of this kind of targeting from a distance. I'm not going to rehearse that here. I mention it in this regard, that even as I'm haunted by the history of air power, its terror, the full register of which seems to escape the conscious recognition of most of my compatriots, suspended between abstraction and numbness, as Favret put it, this work has educated me to the transformative recognition of structures of feeling I might not have known or been able to even dimly perceive. This does not just empower me, although it does, inevitably, but also opens our fields of study to other possibilities of sensibility, the relational, processual, and affective materialities of space and place that McCormick has found in aerostatic spacing. The opposition between distance and proximity belies our closeness, our many links, our terrible acts, our forgiveness, our despair, our joy. Affective presence remotely sensed at multiple scales is always prosthetic, perhaps even haptic, always a technics or mediation between bodies and things. Baldwin lifted off this earth on a fine autumn day, his views folded into ours, signaling the emotion of motion, not as a God's eye view of precision targets, but as an assemblage of uneven pieces, views plural, vision plus. Baldwin saw at least four balloon prospects, maybe more, whereas I can only see one way from above. I try to see as he did, but the printed objects only go so far. I know from his text he was working hard, trying to keep the balloon aloft, experiencing in his body the completely new physics produced by the experience of floating with the wind. Far from the ground, Baldwin never wished to lose sight of it, even as his gaze was drawn upwards and around, all-seeing and yet unable to comprehend all there was to see. He was alive. Or, as another aerialist, the inventor of the hydrogen balloon, Jacques Charles, put it on the occasion of his first and only flight, I examined all my emotions calmly. I could hear myself live, so to speak. Living on, if we're lucky enough, we could perceive flight and the senses otherwise, many ways, beyond vision and the dealing of death. Thank you.